about the kind of God we're talking about. And we start with both a welcome and a warning. We're speaking tonight of a God who does want to be known. A God whose desire is that human beings should be able to relate to him. Yet we also begin with a warning. Because he is a God who, if we were to see face to face, would be so awesome, so holy, so magnificently above and beyond us, we couldn't last a minute in his presence. To meet a God like this is absolutely terrifying. This is a frightening thing that we do tonight, unless we know that the grace of God is here to help us. So we're undertaking a serious task tonight. And I think that as Christian believers, we want to set the framework. We know where we're going, and we've already read it. We're talking about a God who is personal, not a mysterious life force or a philosophical theory, but a being who is a person. In fact, three persons, as we know, but is personal in his nature. We're talking about one who is powerful, a being who is able to act and achieve things and do things. We're talking about a being who communicates, who relates, who in particular is able to communicate to human beings and to make himself known. We're talking about a God who cares. We read in that account from Exodus how he wanted to rescue his people Israel from the nation of Egypt and set them free. He cared about his people. But perhaps the thing that comes through most clearly of all in that reading from Exodus is that he is a God who is holy, a God who is other, a God who is above and beyond us. And we tread on holy ground tonight. We must take very seriously what we do in thinking about him. So that's the framework in which we are working, the goal towards which we are heading. And I wanted us to have that in mind before we then wind back and have a look at some of the more general thinking that's gone on about God. Forgive me for going backwards here. I put these in the wrong order. You might get the impression these days that the direction in the Western world is all away from God towards unbelief. And I wanted to point out at the start that actually that's not the universal direction. Recently there have been some very well-known figures whose direction seems to have changed in this matter. On the left, the elderly gentleman there, his name is Professor Anthony Flew, F-L-E-W, not F-L-U. He is Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at the University of Reading. And for many years was considered one of the key architects for the theories underpinning atheism, the key atheist philosopher. And he rather dismayed his atheist friends in the last year or two by announcing that he had come to believe that there was indeed a God, that he'd been wrong in his atheist teaching all of those years as a philosophy professor. Now, I'll come to see a little bit more about how he came to that conclusion and what exact conclusion he came to in a moment. Now, on the right-hand side, does anybody recognize her? Any literary people here recognize Faye Weldon? Now, Faye Weldon is a feminist author, or would have been known as such for most of her writing career, and not the sort of person you would have thought of as being a Christian believer. But in recent years, she has announced that she too has come to faith, in her case specifically, a Christian faith. So we do actually see that even within the intelligentsia of the Western world, it's not a totally a one-way path away from God into unbelief. But let's think a little bit more about how people have thought about God. In the past, and to some extent today, various arguments would be put forward to try and answer and explain the existence of God. Now, I thought we'd have some long words tonight. You need to, Don't be too frightened. We're going to be explaining the long words in a minute, even with some pictures, so don't be too scared by them. Anybody heard of the ontological existence, argument for the existence of God, from ontology? Yeah. But don't worry about it too much. That was basically a theory that God exists because he ought to, really. And I don't think we're going to spend too long on that one. But if you hear the word or want to find out more about it, then I'll say a bit more. But the following three are arguments that we may find useful this evening. One is the cosmological argument. That's an argument that says everything that happens, happens due to a cause. Assuming the universe isn't eternal or in a circle, there must have been a first cause. Doesn't it make more sense that that first cause should be God rather than stuff in the universe? Then the second class of arguments, and these are the ones that we're perhaps most familiar with, are technically called the teleological arguments for the existence of God, which, putting it another way, are what we call the argument from design, which is to say, look at the universe around you. Doesn't it look like it was made by an intelligent God rather than just happened all by itself? You can understand that, can't you, even if you don't know what teleological means. Then another class of argument, and that's been called the moral argument. That's the argument from ethical experience. The argument that says, come on, we all know there is such a thing as right and wrong. There is such a thing as love and hate. There is some significance to human existence. These things matter. And don't they make much more sense in a universe where there is a God than they do in a universe where there is no God? And these are all arguments that have been used and continue to be used. And I do think that there's a degree of validity within them. And the Bible, I think, helps us to see that thinking this way can get us somewhere. So if you turn to Romans chapter 1, verse 20. Just one verse will do here. In the context here, Paul is showing how the world has gone basically down the pan because it ignored God. Romans 1 verse 20, page 1128 in the Chapel Bible, says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. So you see what he's saying there. He's saying that the universe which exists does, to some extent, reveal some characteristics and indeed the existence of God. But you tell me, notice there, how far does that evidence get people? What does it actually achieve? What's the effect on those who look around the universe of seeing all this evidence of his existence? What does it actually do for them? Without the answer. Sorry? And specifically, that's right, they seek God, but they, yeah, that's right, they've gone completely the other way. Yeah, yeah. And you notice there at the end of verse 20, particularly, is what I'm getting at. That the evidence is there, but it gets us to the point of removing excuses. It doesn't get people to the point of actually believing in God, but what it does is take away the excuse for not believing. And that's as far as I think these traditional arguments from God can go. They take away the excuse for not believing. But to that extent, it is worth looking at this universe around us and seeing that indeed it does point to the existence of a God. What we're really saying is, can you not believe in God in a universe like this? This is a picture of the Big Bang. Well, okay, maybe not. But the point is, we do live in a universe that clearly has a beginning and an end. Science shows us that. Our universe has a beginning. And does it not make more sense to see that beginning as the beginning of a God who initiates things rather than just material that happens? That's the cosmological argument. Here's another argument, just from observing the universe around us. And you'll know prizes for seeing what this is. It's a diagram of the solar system. But a simple observation shows us that, for instance, planet Earth is located in an incredibly serendipitous, that is, a very lucky place in the universe. A little bit further out, and planet Earth would be a frozen ball of ice, rather like Mars. A bit closer in, and it would be a blazing furnace, rather like Venus. But planet Earth seems to be balanced at just the right size and shape, and just the right location from the sun, with seasons and so on that help things to vary, for complex life like ours to exist and to thrive. And of course, there could be billions and billions and billions of stars with even more billions of planets, and therefore we just happen to hit it lucky here on planet Earth. Or does it make more sense to see a guiding hand over in charge of these things? These are examples of the argument from design here. That's sort of from an argument from good luck, really, if you like. Another example. These are diagrams of water molecules. And water, that's oxygen in the middle and a couple of hydrogens stuck on the side. The interesting thing about water is that it's kinked. Can you see it? It's a bit like Mickey Mouse with ears coming off there. Yeah, this sort of face and then the two things coming off. And those are at an angle. And I won't try and explain the chemistry of it, mainly because I've forgotten it myself. But if water wasn't that shape, then it wouldn't stick together at all. Water would just evaporate, and it wouldn't form a liquid. And because it's that shape, another marvelous thing is that it will form a solid that floats. Most liquids form a solid that sinks. But water uniquely forms, not uniquely, but very unusually forms a solid that will float on the surface. What's more, that little kink means that water will dissolve other substances, be a solvent for many other things. And there's many other things that water will do as well. And would you know it, water is one of the most common chemicals on our planet. Without water, life like ours would not be possible. There'd be no seas, or if they were, they'd be covered in a permanent, they'd be full of ice with just a thin film of water on the top. And what else would dissolve all the salts and chemicals that we need for our bodies to function? And it's all down to that precisely calculated kink in the water molecule. As far as we know, that kink is determined by the fundamental laws of the universe. And it seems like the universe has been fine-tuned so that molecules like water could exist and be common. This is a picture of a carbon atom. This is probably an O-level picture. They get much more frightening as you get a bit older. But this is simply meant to illustrate that everything is finely tuned even within the atom itself. So the protons and electrons, their weight is finely balanced. And if they were slightly larger or slightly smaller, molecules like this just wouldn't work. Atoms like this just wouldn't function. Stars wouldn't burn. The theory shows us that there's a very, very narrow, limited range of possibilities for these figures that will function in a universe like ours. And as far as we know, the reason why these things balance out like this is written in to the fundamental laws of the universe. Again, it looks like the universe is fine-tuned so that complex life and things like that can exist. One more picture, another diagram. These are all of small things now. This is a molecule of, no prizes, DNA, discovered by a couple of gentlemen in a bike shed in Cambridge. At least it's a bike shed now, it wasn't then. This is the code of information that informs the cell in the vast majority of organisms that exist. And it's incredibly complex, a huge amount of information packed into that one cell. And it's very hard to build that working strand of DNA from nothing. You have to start with something before you can add more molecules to it. And it's the evidence from this kind of biological work that's persuaded Professor Anthony Flew to change his mind. He says the biologist's investigation of DNA has shown by the almost unbelievable complexity of the arrangements which are needed to produce life that intelligence must have been involved. That's the conclusion that he has come to. There seems to be in our universe irreducible complexity that gaps that evolution could not get across. At least that's that interpretation of the evidence. Where are we up to now? I recognize these are handsome-looking people here. Another dimension to the evidence that I think of is the existence of humanity at all. The Bible tells us that human beings are made in the image of God. And surely as we look at the human race around us, with all our flaws and failings, nonetheless, we see something distinct and special. We see beings who are aware of themselves. We see beings who are aware of other people and able to relate to them and imagine how they're thinking. We see beings with moral awareness, who universally around this world believe there is such a thing as right and wrong, even if we disagree about what they are and how to fulfill them. We see universally around this world beings who are in some sense or other aware of otherness. You don't find, you find animals that use tools to get their food. You find animals that have complex relationships. You find animals that will do all kinds of things, but you don't find animals in church, do you? You don't find monkeys building cathedrals or totem poles. Written into the human experience of life is some kind of sense of the other above and beyond us. And I think that as we look at all those things, it is indeed clear, if we look at them in an objective way, that the excuses for not believing in God are taken away by the evidence that is plain to see for all of us. Of course, you may not be the sort who likes to think in terms of scientific theory and explanation. Maybe you're another type of person. Maybe you're the type of person who likes to just sit back and look at it. So why don't you do that now as I take a different slant on the wonders of this universe? Praise the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty. He wraps himself in light as with a garment. He stretches out the heavens like a tent and lays the beams of his upper chambers on their waters. He makes the clouds his chariot and rides on the wings of the wind. He makes winds his messengers, flames of fire his servants. He set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains, but at your rebuke the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder they took to flight. They flowed over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place you had assigned for them. You set a boundary they cannot cross. Never again will they cover the earth. He makes springs pour water into the ravines. It flows between the mountains. They give water to all the beasts of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. The birds of the air nest by the waters. They sing among the branches. He waters the mountains from his upper chambers. The earth is satisfied by the fruits of his work. He makes grass grow for the cattle and plants for man to cultivate, bringing forth food from the earth, wine that gladdens the heart of men, oil to make his face shine, and bread that sustains his heart. The trees of the Lord are well watered. The cedars of Lebanon he planted. There the birds make their nests. The stork has its home in the pine trees. The high mountains belong to the wild goats. The crags are refuges for the conifers. The lions roar for their prey and seek their food from God. Then man goes out to his work, to his labor until evening. How many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. And as we contemplate the glory of God in creation, why don't we stand now and sing to him and worship him for all that he's done? Let's stand and sing the said. The faith is not an irrational response, but as we look at the universe around us, it's a reasonable conclusion to draw. And as I said already, that being so, it takes away excuses for not believing. We don't look at a universe around us that conclusively disproves the existence of God, not at all. But we must see the limits of how far this can take us. I fully admit that the points I've run through that come from science and so on, they raise as many questions as they do answers. And none of this enables us to know and believe in him by ourselves. Professor Anthony Flew is a good example of this. He has, by looking at the evidence around him in the universe, come to the conclusion that a God exists. But that's as far as he has got. He hasn't got to a belief in the God of the Bible. He simply has concluded that there must be a first mover to set things going in the first place, to set the universe up so that it works. And that's as far as any of us will get if we just look at the universe around us. We won't actually meet him for ourselves. We can only really believe in God because he has revealed himself to us. And that's what we learn from that story of Moses in with the burning bush, isn't it? It's all about how God makes himself present and known to Moses and invites him to come and discover the truth about his divine identity. That's how positively you can come to believe in the true and living God, because he has made himself known, and not just painted his signature on the heavens, but actually made himself personally available to us. This is how Faye Weldon came to appreciate this. She said, "A couple of years ago, I was asked to write a foreword to St. Paul's Epistle to the Corinthians for a publisher. Let me just say that by the time I had finished the introduction, saying the creed caused me no problem. That story is too extraordinary, of the death foretold, of the resurrection, of the very way the story travelled, of the message it carried, to be ignored." It's interesting, of course, isn't it, that Faye Weldon had a great deal to say about St. Paul and the Bible before she actually read it. And it was actually reading it for the first time in order to make an academic introduction to it as a work of literature that she came to be aware of what it actually says. And that's the truth of the matter for a great deal of the intelligentsia who pronounce on Christian faith. Very often, not universally, but very often, they haven't really got into depths of what it actually says. But Faye Weldon found that when she actually opened the Bible and read it seriously, it spoke to her, and it compelled a belief within her. Now, I don't think she's quite at the place where we'd say she was an evangelical Christian, but this has got her so much closer to the true and living God than simply looking at atoms and DNA, hasn't it? So how can you believe in God? Well, let me remind you of, if you were here on Sunday morning anyway, of how some other people came to believe in God. Some people in Thessalonica. Turn to 1 Thessalonians, the book that we're looking at in the morning, and just spot one or two verses in those first chapters that we looked at. Look how, for instance, Paul describes what had happened in their hearts and their minds. It says, verse 9, halfway through, they tell how you turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God. So you see there, the people he's addressing weren't Jews who had some knowledge of God already, but total pagans whose beliefs were in the pagan gods of the ancient Greek world. So their world had been turned around, and they had had proved to them the living and true God and the truth about him. And that had taken them out of their unbelief and into true belief. How is it that this living true God makes himself known in our world today? Well, in the past, he spoke through the prophets, didn't he? In all kinds of marvelous ways, rather like Moses meeting him in the burning bush, or Isaiah going into the temple and seeing a vision, and that kind of thing. But now, he has spoken to us through a son, hasn't he? He has spoken to us by becoming a human being, Jesus Christ, who we can know and relate to on the human level. And that is the ultimate revelation of God. And in your own time, you can look up how that works out in John's Gospel, chapter 1. But remember, that's how the Thessalonians had come to the conviction that God was real and true and alive, wasn't it? That Paul had come and told them about Jesus Christ. He'd come and said that this man Jesus is the Christ. So you can believe in God through Jesus. And how can you believe in Jesus? Well, Jesus is revealed to us, first and foremost, through the Bible. That's how he speaks to us. Or as Paul says to the Thessalonians, through the Lord's message, there in 1 verse 8. Or the gospel of God. The good news about Jesus is contained for us now in written words, on which we can rely and through which we can come and actually know God in person. In this way. And how do those words get off the page and into your heart? Well, that's the work of God too. The Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit picks up words from a page and turns them and writes them into your spiritual DNA, if you like. So they actually start to affect the way you live, what you breathe and think in your heart. As Paul had said to the Thessalonians, the gospel had come not simply with words, but also with power, with the Holy Spirit, and with deep conviction. And this is how God makes himself known today, and this is how you and I can come to actually, positively know and believe in him for ourselves. And fundamentally, it's something that he does for us, to which we can only respond. The atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell is famous for answering a certain question. Somebody said to him, what about if at the end of time you die and you discover to your horror that there really is a God and you got it wrong all along? What was one question that you would want to ask him? One thing you'd want to say? And Bertrand Russell's answer was, I would want to say, why didn't you give us more evidence? Where was the evidence? That's what he felt the problem was. What he didn't realize was that the problem with him knowing God wasn't God. The problem was him. The problem wasn't the evidence, but with the person who was looking at the evidence. The problem wasn't even his brain as such. It wasn't even an intellectual endeavor, as if it were wrong to seek good reasons to believe, as if it was silly for us to want our faith to be founded on truth. No, the problem wasn't the mind so much as the heart of the man. If God were to show himself in the way that the likes of Bertrand Russell wants, he would have to squeeze himself into the test tube. He would have to jump through the hoops that we set to demonstrate his reality. He would have to stand in the dock and answer for himself. And however high the hoop he jumps through, we would say, just a little bit more, please, God. Jump through that hoop, a little smaller test tube, so we can examine you more closely. If God were to do that, he would no longer be the holy, true, and living God. He would become a mere idol, a mere philosophical theory, a mere piece of our human grand theory of everything. And God will not show himself that way. There is plenty out there to make it rational for us to believe in him. But ultimately, the real issue is not God, it's us. The real issue is not what kind of God he is, but what kind of person that a God like him is able to reveal himself to. So, of course, when we want to know and understand God, of course, we exert ourselves. We seek him. We do our best to understand what's going on. Of course, we do. But far more important than exerting ourselves to understand and asking him the hard questions, the most important thing is that we humble ourselves. That we acknowledge that he is God and we are but man. And if he chooses to show himself to us, then it's out of his grace and his mercy and his love. Not because we have any right to it at all, but because he is a loving God who wants to do it for the likes of us. No more than Moses could set fire to the burning bush himself and call God to come down, could we require God to show himself to us. The best we can do is humble ourselves, bow the knee, and ask him to do so out of his mercy and grace. And if you're wrestling with this kind of question, this kind of problem, then I suggest that you spend a little time thinking about yourself as well as him. Are you the kind of person who is able to appreciate a God like this? And if not, ask him that you become such a person.